Well, 8 years ago now, back in 2015, so right at the beginning of their mandate, one of their campaign promises, in fact, for the Liberals and the federal government was to bring clean drinking water to First Nation communities in Canada. And they set a deadline for themselves, too. It was 2021, 6 years. As you know, that deadline came and went and didn't work. A great many First Nations still under boil water advisories dealing with clean drinking water issues. So this week, 8 years later, in 2023, the government has tabled a bill that is aimed at addressing some of these long-standing issues. So is it a case of better late than ever? And does it do what we've needed it to do for some time now? We're going to speak with Veldon Coburn, who is an assistant professor at the University of Ottawa Institute of Indigenous Research and Study. Veldon, thanks so much for being here today. I appreciate your time.
It's a pleasure. Good morning.
So this bill that we had that was tabled this week, I don't think that anybody's taken a victory lap on its arrival, seeing how it's been a really long time coming, right? We should have had this a number of years ago.
Yeah, well, you know, incidentally, when I was a public servant, I worked specifically on the sort of predecessor bill that was repealed last year. It was introduced by the Harper government in 2013. It took about 2 years. It was introduced in the House of Commons and eventually in the Senate. It was a weird bill that was, because it had been proposed by the Senate, was introduced as a Senate bill first, but it was repealed and replaced just recently with the introduction of this. And it's got a longer title, but it's to assure clean water on First Nations. So, so 8 years into the mandate of the Trudeau government, and water quality still a pressing issue in many First Nations. It's done considerably better. So this was actually, again, my file that I worked on in both policy and programming in what was then INAC, is Indigenous Northern Affairs Canada.
Yeah.
And worked on the, and this is where it departs a little bit, is there was consultation on this, whereas the last bill, the Safe Water Act, it was not, there was no consultations back in 2010-11, sort of rammed through, and it ruffled First Nations, because the predecessor that was repealed last year, it imposed a lot of regulations on them that they could never meet. It would be like me coming to inspect your house today and say, well, you know what, today I have a whole lot of regulations for you. And you say, well, can you sort of grandfather me in? And they're like, no, you're just going to have to tear down your entire house. And say, well, how's that fair? But you know, there are, you know, water quality and safety issues and public health measures, I think we can all objectively agree, is like, well, you can't really dance around the edges too much when it comes to unsafe drinking water. And also it encapsulates the treatment of wastewater. So human waste, dishwash, whatever's like slop pails that are used in First Nations, because a lot still don't have internal plumbing. It's like, what do you do with it to treat it? So there is no water treatment for disposable water, like bathtub water, toilet water, whatever. But also just the drinking water, which is still the pressing issue. So this government goes on and does a lot more consultation, which is far more admirable, but I guess some people feel left out as well, too.
But that was an important piece, right? As you mentioned, I mean, the safe drinking water, I mean, that's pretty clear cut. Either you have it or you don't. So, but a big piece that's been missing and is now actually included in this legislation is the collaboration. In fact, there's actually a First Nations-led commission on this, right? So that's an important piece, and it looks like, at least as we see it now, that will be incorporated into this moving forward.
That's right. So what this does in this particular bill is recognize certain authorities too, which were missing from the last bill, where they said, well, we don't actually have any kind of control over even the transparency and accountability to it. So reporting and so like First Nations, if you were a corrupt First Nation, you could probably start covering up poor water quality. Is like, you know, governments of all sorts cut corners here and there, especially when there's budget constraints. Ontario experienced this, I guess, in the early 2000s with the Walkerton. It's like, well, we're hiding a little bit of the testing results. And until there was a human crisis as well, too. So in this case, though, where there was also a lack of entire lack of jurisdictional clarity was with the, who was accountable? Was it Ottawa that was accountable to come into First Nations and impose it, and therefore they'd be the ones, or would First Nations have jurisdiction to say, well, you're responsible, but you're not doing anything. If we took responsibility, we would do something.
Right.
And therefore, so install these mechanisms of accountability where a First Nations water commissioner can hold us to account.
Which is an important step forward.
That's right. Because self-policing, that can fail sometimes. Like, we see it at all different levels of government. So outside authority, whereas sadly the history of the first, or the federal government, is what they were doing was imposing regulations and de facto imposing it upon themselves, in which they would ignore. So that was part of it, and saying, well, if you're going to maintain responsibility for the water systems, come in and make sure that the operation and maintenance and the actual water quality is up to these standards. Yeah. Otherwise, we'll do it ourselves.
Right, exactly.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. What about the funding model that's here? Because it's not a one-time thing, which I think is pretty important, right? I mean, when you take a look at it, Veldon, you don't want just a chunk of money, off you go. This was part of the problem, or part of the promise, I guess, from Patty Hajdu, is this is funding in perpetuity. We're not going to just say, here's some money, fix it. No, we're going to continue to fund it. I mean, the system takes money to operate. So how important is that to have that piece incorporated as well?
It's extraordinarily important, because the analogy that we would use is that there would be very quick rust out of systems. So I worked with a lot of engineers, and I was lucky. I got to learn a lot about infrastructure engineering too, because we worked on water and wastewater infrastructure, and they would build a nice new, like, $3 or $4 million water treatment plant. And without the follow-up for the operations and maintenance funding to support it, it's like buying a car and letting it rust out in your driveway. Yep. And then you can't use it after a few years. And this infrastructure should have a life cycle of, they try to extend them up to where 60, maybe 80 years, and then they were rusting out after 20, 25 years, so maybe a third of their life. And so the replacement cost of them, and which would often be delayed, and you'd also have at the end of that life, pretty quickly, so the last 10 years of poor water quality, poor wastewater treatment quality, sort of that suffering, and then get on the list again to wait another 10 or 15, maybe 20 years for more funding to come around for a replacement. So if it were my teenage kid and I bought them a new car and they just drove it into the ground after 2 years, I said, no, that should last you about 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, you're going to have to continue driving it for 10 years. And they, well, you know, it's very hazardous to my health because I might lose my life in it. And then after 10 years, come back and I'll see what's in the bank, because I can possibly replace it with a proposal for within the next couple of years thereafter. So, yeah, so the operations and maintenance, it's protecting your investments as well, too. So what this federal government has done, I think more, and I don't use the word stealthily in a stigmatized way, is finally acknowledging First Nations jurisdiction. Because there are some ineptness, or at least I guess the distance and the proximity from Ottawa to First Nations, managing over 600 First Nations as though they were municipalities, the same way that provinces would, and provide funding through provincial taxes to divide up through municipalities to run their own public services and public infrastructure, is to provide that for operations and maintenance, and saying, First Nations, you're the owners and operators. And we'll kind of get out of the way.
Yeah, exactly.
But, yeah.
Which is fantastic. I think it makes a lot of sense. Veldon, thank you so much for your time. I really do appreciate you being here today.
Canada may be known for its landscapes and friendly people, but beneath the surface lies a darker side of crime, history, and the paranormal. Since 2017, the award-winning Dark Poutine podcast has explored the shadowy corners of the Great White North and beyond, delivering chilling tales from a uniquely Canadian perspective. Hosted by Mike Brown and Matthew Stockton, with over 300 episodes and fresh releases every Monday, Dark Poutine is your weekly ticket to the creepier side of Canada. Listen to Dark Poutine on Apple, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts.